The car door closes. The mailbox opens. The key turns in the lock. It's 7:30 p.m. My heart is racing. I come alive. Life resumes. Just before he enters, I go to the second floor window and watch him cross the flowery driveway to determine whether he seems happy or not to be home. He doesn't seem in any kind of hurry, nor does he fix his hair before opening the door, but he has a slight smile on his lips. My husband is always sending me contradictory signals. I go back downstairs to welcome him. The smell of the chicken roasting perfects this scene, which I've already played out several times in my head. My husband kisses the children on the forehead and me on the cheek. His false modesty revolts me. They're not stupid. They know their parents kiss on the mouth, so why does he refuse to do it in front of them? It worries me that my husband isn't more effusive. What do my children think of our relationship? Do they believe that their father is in love with me? They're only children, but they are nevertheless the most privileged witnesses of our love. And they say that children can sense this kind of thing, that they're emotional sponges, something to do with mirror neurons. I'd like to ask them, but I haven't found a way to broach the subject. Maybe we'll be able to discuss it more easily when they're teenagers. Will we finally be able to talk about love and the meaning of life at the dinner table? Among all the rituals of shared life, the very regulated choreography of the family meal is the one that annoys me the most. This afternoon, we were two lovers sitting on a restaurant terrace. Passers-by could have taken us for two co-workers burning with desire for each other who have not yet dared make the first move, or two former lovers trying to say goodbye for good, impossible to know for certain from the outside. Tonight, however, the roles we perform are unambiguous. We are two parents having dinner with their children, a classic family portrayal. I play the mother, and he the father, and I miss my husband. Everyone knows their part. My husband keeps the dinner lively, conducting the conversation as though it's his mission to make our children speak. At least I don't have to dread a lull. He asks them questions, then asks again, demanding precision, requesting that they rephrase what they've said, surveying the coherent articulation of their thoughts, school, extracurriculars, their education, their music classes, the end-of-year concert at the conservatory. As for me, I smile at them with as much benevolence as I'm capable of as I listen to them speak. Because, to be honest, what's shared over dinner is of very little interest to me. I ask my husband about his day, but his responses are vague. I can't even be angry at him about it. He can't give me the details of the complicated case he's working on, share his concern over his parents' health, or speak openly about his desires. Not in front of the children. At their age, they're old enough to understand, but too young to care. We speak without anything important ever being said around our table, which profoundly frustrates and bores me. Fortunately, my children have always gone to bed earlier than other kids their age. I've reminded them hundreds of times of the importance of a good night's sleep. I've described in great detail all the essential processes that occur overnight. Their muscles relax and rest. Their brain integrates and sorts the memories of the day. Their imagination works overtime to churn out vibrant dreams. Their growth hormones spread through their bodies to make them taller. And so my children like to go to bed early. In reality, encouraging my children's sleep is an egotistical mission, calculated for my own purposes, so that I can spend several hours alone with my husband each night. But the older my children get, the later their bedtime is pushed back and, inevitably, the time spent alone with my husband diminishes. Miserable and powerless, I witness the transformation of our couple into a family. My children are old enough now to read alone in their beds, but my husband continues to read a few pages with them every night. When they were young, he would tell them stories about the kings of France. He would begin with the Merovingian dynasty, then the Carolingian, then the direct Capetians and the Valois. Finally, he would arrive at the Bourbons and begin again. He followed the chapters of a large red book with pages worn from being turned so many times, but the book was only a pretext, the starting point for a story that he embellished with new anecdotes each time. Louis XIII's stutter, the gossip of Louis XIV's court, the swift ascension of Nicolas Fouquet, and various questions. Who was the last son of Louis IX? Diane de Poitiers was whose favorite? What queen was responsible for the Palais du Luxembourg? These detours into dates, characters, and battles enraptured our children. My husband never told them the same story twice. I didn't like when the story revolved around Henri IV, who was notoriously unfaithful. I preferred the adventures of Louis XV. He was a mediocre king, true, but at least he remained faithful to the same mistress all his life. But my favorite story takes place on the other bank of the Rhine, the story of General Bismarck, who loved his wife with a constancy and fervor unequaled in history. Never a dalliance, even when his military campaigns distanced him from his beloved for months on end. When we were a young couple with no children, my husband would read me love poems by Paul Eluard and passages from In Search of Lost Time on Sunday morning while we drank our coffee in bed. Now he reads aloud to our children. 20th century poetry and Marcel Proust have left the bedroom and obediently resumed their place in the living room library. I also read many stories to our children when they were little, but it came less naturally for me than for my husband. I never struck the right tone, and I could never imitate the voices of the characters as well as him. The very act made me uncomfortable. It was impossible for me to gauge what their young minds understood of the adventures I was recounting to them, whether I was going too fast or too slow. At night in their bedroom, time stretched on and the books seemed endless. Now my daughter is 7, almost 8. When I read her a story, I try to choose one in which there's no prince, no romance. I buy her books with independent heroines who defy dragons, sail warships, dig up dinosaur bones. Choosing such a story is part of the painful responsibility I feel toward my daughter. I want to prevent her at all costs from making the same mistakes as I did. I love our children. That goes without saying. I love them, but still, I would rather have not had them. I love them, but I would rather have lived alone with my husband. Today, I think I can say with certainty that I could survive the death of one of my children, but not of my husband. Giving him a child brought us closer, especially at the beginning, when the three of us were living in isolation. It was a commitment for life. I would always be the mother of his children, and a precious complicity. The two of us shared the difficult nights when our son's ear infection kept us awake till dawn. This little boy was one more thing we had in common, an inexhaustible topic of conversation, the proof and the concretization of his love for me. But it wasn't enough to inspire as much love for my son as it should have. When my husband went back to work and I found myself home alone with a newborn, I felt like a prisoner, trapped in the role of mother, which I had no desire to play and for which I had no talent. I felt nothing when this infant was sleeping against my shoulder. Later on, I never knew what to say to our children on the way back from school. No maternal instinct for me. I never managed to appear fascinated like the other parents did when their children recounted their days. I never managed to be interested in their games, their problems, their friendships. I never managed to slow myself down to their pace. Although now my children move at a reasonable speed, for a long time their slowness exasperated me. My daughter in the stroller, my son walking next to us, me always repeating, "Don't let go of the stroller, always keep your hand on it." Going between daycare and the house, 724 meters, felt like going from Paris to Tokyo, 9,710 kilometers. I love my children, but their presence weighs on me. Not being able to speak about anything of substance at night around the table, having to wait for them to be asleep to make love with my husband, counting on one hand the weekends I've spent alone with him in the last 10 years, losing time when we go places. When we're together, I walk 4.7 kilometers per hour, While alone, I walk 6.8, not to mention my body, which I watched deform during my pregnancies. Fortunately, it was a temporary distortion, as I was able to lose all the weight I'd gained. Obviously, I chose not to breastfeed my children. I was too attached to the perkiness of my chest to give up such an important aspect of my femininity for them. As a mother, I'm not present enough, devoted enough, attentive enough. When I go to pick up my children at school, there is always a group of parents talking in a corner. I wave to them and act as though I'm in a hurry, which allows me to avoid saying hello. In reality, I'm afraid that they'll ask me to work a booth at the school party, or that they'll realize over the course of a conversation that I don't know the names of their children, even though they always ask me about mine. I read somewhere that there are three kinds of women: the woman in love, the mistress, and the mother. That seems right to me. I spent my childhood and adolescence being the woman in love. My dreams for the future were inspired by sappy novels, and the only films I deemed worthy of my interest were those that portrayed love stories. The endings didn't matter to me, as long as the love was passionate. As a young woman, I continued my search for a great love. I still had no desire to be a mistress. Loving without any commitment held no appeal. And then, when I had children, I never moved to the next stage. I never changed categories to become a mother. I do my best, but most of the time I'm too busy being in love to be a good mother.